Hi, this is Marlena Lieberg welcoming you to Blind Spot. Blind Spot is a series of programs heard this time each week on ACB Radio where we talk no-tech, low-tech kinds of things. If you've got an idea for something you'd like to hear on Blind Spot, why not drop me an email? My email address is Marlena, that's M-A-R-L-A-I-N-A, at acbradio.org. Hello and welcome to Blind Spot. I'm Marlena Lieberg, and this week we are going to be talking about sleep, or perhaps more appropriately in some of us, the lack thereof. My guest this week is Dr. Stephen W. Lockley. I came across Dr. Lockley from, I guess I got an email from someone at the Brigham and Women's Hospital telling me about a sleep disorder study in blind people that they were doing there. And, of course, I jumped right on that and thought, we've had so many requests for someone to come on and talk about sleep disorders in people who are blind here on Blind Spot that I thought this would be a great interview, and Dr. Lockley answered me and was very eager to participate. Dr. Lockley has developed the single largest database in the world regarding body clock disturbances in the blind. And in a sleep disorder questionnaire which was done, and Dr. Lockley, correct me if I get this wrong here, but 60% of the registered blind subjects had a sleep disorder as defined by that questionnaire, whereas only 16, that's 1/6% of the sighted subjects had a sleep disorder identified by the questionnaire. In addition, the numbers were greater for those who were totally blind, up to 2/3. Of those persons who are totally blind registered as having a sleep disorder. And of that number, 27% had a severe sleep disorder. Good evening, Dr. Lockley, and welcome to Blind Spot.
Thank you, Marlene. It's very good to be here.
And did I do okay with all those statistics?
Yeah, those numbers are perfect. We're among several studies that have done sort of questionnaire surveys of blind people. There have been studies done in Germany, in France, other ones in Britain, and some in America, which give fairly equal numbers. There is some variation. The sort of number ranges from around 20% to around 60% of people with some degree of sight loss have a sleep disorder, and this has been done on several different types of questionnaire and in several different countries. So there's pretty good evidence now that blind people in general, whether they have light perception or not, do tend to have more sleep disorders than the sighted population.
So what is a sleep disorder?
It's a good question. Sleep disorders can be many different things, and sleep disorders are not necessarily all due to having rhythm disorders or a lack of light perception. Sleep disorders can be anything that really affects how you sleep. There are different types of disorders, such as insomnia, which is an inability to sleep at night. People have disorders in the timing of their sleep, so they're unable to go to sleep when they want and end up feeling very tired in the early evening or very tired very late at night. And there are some sleep disorders caused by other physiological problems, such as sleep apnea, which is when people have problems with breathing and their upper airway becomes partly blocked, and they have problems breathing when they sleep and then wake up. And there are things such as periodic leg movements. People move their legs a lot at night, which cause them to have sleep disorders. There are many, many different things which can stop you from either sleeping at night or make you feel very tired during the day.
Would I necessarily know it if I had a sleep disorder?
It's a very good question. I mean, the problem with defining people's sleep disorders, it's very subjective. How you define how you sleep may be very different to how someone else defines their sleep. So you might think that 6 or 7 hours a night is very good, whereas someone else might think that that's not really enough. So if people have sleep problems, then the best thing to do is speak to their primary care physician or go to a sleep clinic so a proper medical assessment can be done to see if there is a proper sleep disorder.
Can most sleep disorders be treated?
Yes, most can, but it's very difficult to give a sort of broad treatment to each individual type of sleep disorder. Most depend depend on the individual. And you need to do a detailed assessment to really work out what the exact sleep problem is, and then make sure you have the treatment specific to that sleep disorder, and also specific to that person. So there are very many different things you can do, such as behavioral changes to help people have a better sleep hygiene and a better schedule. But there are also some medications people can take, particularly with circadian sleep disorders. Then you can also use things like light therapy to try and help with sleep. So again, they're very it's very difficult to make a generalized statement. People would need to see a physician, and then they would judge the treatment for that individual.
Now, if a person is blind, would light therapy give them any relief?
It is possible. There was a study done and published in 1995 in the New England Journal of Medicine by Dr. Charles Sizer at the Harvard Medical School and Brigham and Women's Hospital, where they showed that a very small number of people, even though they are visually blind, were still sensitive to light as far as the circadian system was concerned. So the body clock was still able to see light, even though they weren't able to see light for vision. And in such individuals, then light may be a possible therapy. However, the numbers of people who have this property are probably very small, and it wouldn't apply to most people with no light perception.
You know, that's interesting to me, actually, because I am totally blind. In fact, I have had both eyes enucleated, and so that's pretty blind.
Yep.
You can't get much blinder than that. And yet, I can frequently tell you whether a room is light or dark, whether the moon is out. And the way I describe it is I see it through my forehead. And I know that sounds really crazy, but what you've just said has given me hope that maybe I'm not just off the mark here, and that there is some way of sensing light in some people.
Well, the studies that showed that people did have this so-called circadian photoception were in people who still had some intact eyes. So the studies were unable to show effects of light in people who had their eyes removed. And all of our studies done so far show that people who have been bilaterally enucleated have a body clock which is unaffected by light and have a cyclic sleep-wake disorder. So we do think that the effects of light are mediated through the eyes rather than through another part of the brain.
Interesting.
But in lower animals, things like lizards and birds do have a so-called third eye, or a deep brain photoreceptor, where light does go through the skull and affects photoreceptor systems, or affects part of the brain, going directly through the skull as well as through the eyes. But that type of light effect has not been confirmed in mammals, and certainly not in humans. So we wouldn't suspect that somebody who'd had their eyes removed would still be able to sense light for their body clocks.
That's interesting.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, very interesting. Our telephone number is area code 212-812-2800, and the lines are open for your calls now, and the PIN is 0480-5512, and we're talking tonight with Dr. Stephen W. Lockley about sleep disorders among people who are blind. Were there any noted sleep disturbances? Were there any differences based on age among the blind subjects?
We did look at that. We did try to see whether there was a change in age, and we probably didn't study enough people, even though it was the largest database so far put together. We didn't see a difference in sleep disorders with age. However, there is good evidence in sighted people that sleep disorders do increase with increased age. But it probably isn't due to having a disorder of your circadian system. Something might happen to your sleep centers in the brain as you age. So although no one's been able to really look at it in visually impaired people, there's certainly some evidence that sleep does change when you get older, and that you wake up earlier in the night and you find it more difficult to get to sleep and to stay asleep. So there are certainly age-related sleep changes. But we've probably not studied enough people to really know for certain whether that occurs in visually impaired people.
And what about various eye conditions? There are a number of people my age, which is 51, who have what was called RLS and is now called ROP, because all things change, don't they? And literally everyone that I know with RLS, including myself, has wacko sleep problems. And I'm wondering if that is a bit more inherent in those of us who were preemies?
It's true that people with ROP do have some sleep disorders, but again, it tends to be very individual. There are some people, even though they don't have light perception, are able to maintain very good sleep-wake rhythms, whereas other people with exactly the same type of disorder can have very, very bad sleep and have this cyclic sleep-wake problem where you tend to go through periods of good sleep and periods of bad sleep and on a continuous cycle. So it really does depend on the individual. There seems to be some ability of some people to sort of override or to have a bit more control over their timing of sleep. So again, it's very difficult to make generalizations. The only thing that we did notice is that people who had been bilaterally enucleated, all of those individuals had this cyclic sleep-wake disorder, and it's called non-24-hour sleep-wake disorder, where your sleep pattern goes through cycles of good sleep and bad sleep, and the bad sleep is characterized by very much tiredness in the day, a lot of daytime naps, and very difficult to get to sleep at night. And then gradually the sleep starts to get better and people have good sleep at night and feel alert in the day. And then the bad sleep comes back in this sort of continuous cycle, this non-24-hour pattern of sleep. And people who'd had their eyes removed, all of those people had that disorder. So we would suspect someone with no light perception to have a sleep disorder, but there are some individuals who don't seem to be affected by it. And we need to study more people with different types of disorders to really try and get to the answer of your question.
And we have a call, so let's put them on the air. Good evening, you're on Blind Spot. Good evening, you're on Blind Spot.
Hi there, Marlena Lieberg. It's Mike Capel in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Hi, Mike. What's your question tonight?
Well, this guy's interesting. I do actually have, I think, what he was just talking about. Lately, I do take a lot of naps, and then what'll happen is I'll wake up like at 7 o'clock in the morning, and I'll feel pretty good. And then like 2 hours later, I'll just get extremely tired, take another hour nap, wake up, feel fatigued, and then I'm up for about a good 4 hours, and then I take another nap, and then I don't get to bed till about 1 o'clock. How do we go? And I've got ROP as well. How do we go about trying to kind of cure that or fix that? Or is there a remedy for that?
It's a good question. There is a remedy, but before we talk about that, I'd like to just tell people how to maybe really work out whether they have this type of psychic sleep disorder. One thing that you could do is keep a sleep diary and try and work out if there's a pattern to these sleep problems, and try to work out whether there's a fixed number of weeks or fixed number of months in between the good sleep and the bad sleep, to see if we can work out how long your cycle length is.
So I really never get a full, I mean, this has been for a while now, it's been 3 months, where I feel like a full night's rest.
So it's permanently in this sort of disrupted state, it never goes into a good sleep period where you do sleep well at night and sleep
right.
Alert in the day.
Right.
There are two types of conditions which are related to body clock disorders. And these are things called advanced sleep phase syndrome and delayed sleep phase syndrome. And this is people who either want to go to sleep very, very early in the day or very early in the early evening and then wake up in the middle of the night. And there are some individuals who want to go to sleep very, very late in the night and tend to wake up later in the day. And there are sighted people who also have these disorders. And we did find in some people with no light perception these two types of problems, where people are either in a way set to an earlier time or set to a later time than most of the population. And the symptoms you described may be that type of condition where your body clock is set at a slightly later time, which makes you want to go to sleep later and stay in bed later in the morning, and then makes you have this sleepiness in the early day. But again, it's worthwhile keeping some sort of diary or keeping some sort of track of whether these things change, because often these cyclic sleep disorders can last for very many, many months without changing a great deal, but then might go into a good phase. And by tracking how long the cycle is, it can help us with the treatment for the condition, because we can work out sometimes when to give the treatments we could use. or some people like to know how long their cycle's been, their cycles can be, in order to adapt their lifestyle to the changes that they know are coming up. So if they've got some very important event coming up, they try to arrange that so it's not in the time when they're in this period of bad sleep.
And what treatments are available?
Well, one treatment which we have done some work on is using melatonin treatment.
Oh, my gosh. Blind people keep melatonin in business.
Now, unfortunately, there aren't many well-controlled studies of using melatonin in blind people. There have been two studies published, one by myself and my colleagues in England, and then there's been another paper published recently in the New England Journal of Medicine by two workers who work in Portland, Oregon, Dr. Robert Sack and Dr. Alfred Louis. And both of our studies show that you can use either 10 milligrams or 5 milligrams of melatonin to reset the clock and to reset both your sleep-wake rhythm and all your hormonal rhythms and all your temperature rhythms and all the things that go wrong when you have a circadian disorder. But that the timing of the melatonin is crucial. It isn't just a simple matter of taking it at bedtime and then hoping it makes you sleep better. The only way we've been able to show a resetting effect by giving melatonin is to know an individual's own body clock, to work out the timing of their own body clock, and then arrange the treatment at a specific time in each individual's clock. And only when we've done that can we say that we've really reset the clock and improved people's sleep significantly. So unfortunately, although it sometimes says on the bottle you could just take at bedtime, if you really want to cure the sleep disorder and reset the system, then it really needs to be specifically timed to each individual, which of course then makes it difficult to give general advice on how to take melatonin.
Okay, well, thanks very much, and Marlena, I love Blind Spot, and you guys have a good night.
Well, thank you, Mike. Thanks for calling.
Thanks,
Mike. You know, I did have a couple of melatonin questions here on my list, a couple of which you've answered, but one that I do have, when we go to purchase melatonin, you know, there are all sorts of varieties and kinds and types and strengths, and as I understand it, what you're saying is suggesting a 5 or 10 milligram melatonin. Is there anything else that we could look for when purchasing melatonin, such as whether it's blended with something or whatever?
Well, first of all, the dose, we could talk briefly about the dose. Unfortunately, we haven't completed the studies yet looking at lower doses of melatonin. Dr. Louis and Dr. Sack's study showed that if you started by taking 10 milligrams and reset the clock with 10 milligrams, you could reduce the dose to 0.5 milligrams and still keep the clock reset in 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we showed you could just give 5 milligrams and keep taking that, and it will keep you at the right time if you take it at the right time according to your body clock.
Mm-hmm.
So you can, once you've had a higher dose, the published work suggests that you can reduce the dose to a lower one and still maintain the circadian rhythmicity. We are doing studies looking at giving lower doses initially to see whether if you give a lower dose straight away you can reset the clock. However, the problem with purchasing melatonin is that people should be very careful about the source they obtain melatonin from. In all our studies we only use pharmaceutically tested and safe sources of melatonin that we have tested ourselves and know contain the right doses of melatonin.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't want to advise people to necessarily buy melatonin off the shelves because the doses can be variable, and as you mentioned, they're often sold with other things such as vitamins, for example, and we don't really know how melatonin reacts with these other compounds you could put with the drug and then how that affects your rhythms. So all of our studies have been done with pure research standard melatonin, and I would advise people to try and obtain properly tested and validated melatonin that they know contains exactly the right amount. And we do have some sources that we could maybe give to you after the show that we know is validated and would be good for people to take. But it's very difficult to sort of comment on the melatonin sold in health food stores because we haven't tested every compound.
Well, and the first that I ever heard of melatonin actually... I participated in a study back in 1979, I think, at NIH when I lived in the Washington, D.C. area, and they were testing the serotonin level
right.
in the brains of people who were totally blind. And the doctor then told me about melatonin, and I forgot about it, you know. But then seeing some of the listserv traffic among the blindness-related lists, it really is true that there is a huge sleeping problem among the majority of blind people. And, boy, once people found out about melatonin, some people just absolutely swear by it. So I think that that would be a good resource to have, and perhaps at the end of the program you could give an email address or a contact point that would work for you if people wanted to get a hold of you.
Yes, we'll do that. I mean, the treatment of melatonin, when it works in people, as you say, is spectacular. People do report having very good sleep and have a big change in what their sleep habits are. But as I said before, it isn't a simple matter of just taking it at bedtime. And maybe some of the people who have taken it previously have sort of given it at the right time, rather more by luck than really by judgment. And we know from some of the research we've done and that Dr. Lewin Sack have done that if you do time it specifically to people, you can get much better effects. And so if people can join research programs and people can get more information about their own body clocks, even the simple matter of keeping a sleep diary would give you enough information to make a good estimate of when to start the melatonin treatment. If you knew that your cycle was 30 days long, or you knew it was 50 days long, or 100 days long, or whatever it is, then we can predict when to start taking the melatonin and hopefully get it at the right time according to your body clock and make sure we then reset the clock. The problem is that if you take melatonin at the wrong time according to your body clock, you can still get some sleep improvement, a very slight sleep improvement, because melatonin itself sort of facilitates sleep. It helps people sleep. But if we want to really get the effect of resetting the clock, which is the main purpose of the research we're doing, then we do need to specifically time it. But a simple sleep diary and knowing that your cycle lasts so many days could be really helpful to a physician who's trying to prescribe melatonin and trying to get you to take it at the right time.
Oh, we have two calls. Goodness gracious, we'll take them one at a time. Good evening. You're on Blind Spot with Dr. Lockley.
Well, good evening. Good evening, Marlena.
Good evening, Dan.
Yes, indeed. I've been waiting for this program.
Oh, good.
Because remember, we got on the subject of melatonin one night.
I do remember that.
But what is interesting to me, and I don't know if the doctor has ever run across this, I have noticed that when you take melatonin, or at least when I do, the dreams get really, really vivid and you remember them, as opposed to sometimes you just don't remember them. It seems like more often I'll run into periods of time where I do remember them. Does a doctor, have you done any research in that regard?
No, I haven't done any research with melatonin and dreaming, although people have reported exactly what you've just said, that your perception of the dreams may change. But rather than the dreams themselves, we do know that melatonin affects sleep stages. You have different stages of sleep. So you have stages where you have rapid eye movement, and you have stages where you have non-rapid eye movement. And melatonin can alter sleep stages and increase the number of hours you would have or the number of minutes you would have of a particular sleep stage. But the other thing to keep in mind is that the melatonin may be shifting your body clock, which is then making you sleep better, which is then maybe having a knock-on effect of changing the sleep stages, which may then affect how you perceive your dreams. So, and I don't know of any very well-controlled studies looking at the relationship between dreaming and melatonin. But
now, one other question about melatonin, then I'll let some other callers chime in. Do you know of any negative side effect to melatonin?
Yes, there are some side effects. The biggest classification of side effects was done in a study where melatonin was used for jet lag. And that study showed that some people do get headaches. Around 8% of people who took 5 milligrams of melatonin did experience a headache the next morning after taking it. So some people do have this headache effect, and by maybe changing the dose to a lower dose, that may be one way of preventing that side effect. One side effect is sleepiness, which, of course, we may want in some cases. But if you're taking melatonin in the daytime or you take it at the wrong time for your body clock, then that sleepiness could then interfere with your sleep either the next night or could interfere with your activities during the day. And we should also keep in mind when taking melatonin that it's not something that we would advise under 18s to take or pregnant women to take, because there are some animal studies which show that melatonin can influence reproductive development. And we wouldn't advise that melatonin be taken by children or by lactating or pregnant women. So there are some safety issues to think about when taking melatonin, as well as the things we talked about before, about people putting other things in melatonin where we don't really know what happens when you combine melatonin with other vitamins, for example.
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks, Dan. And maybe we've got our next caller. Good evening. You're on Blind Spot with Dr. Lockley. Hello.
Good evening, Marlena. How are you doing?
Good evening, Richard.
Yes, doctor. One thing I was kind of curious about with this is that for myself, I found out very much later in life that I had a underactive thyroid, and I'm taking replacement as well. So I know that diabetes seems to be the leading one of the leading causes of blindness, and I was just curious as if the people that you also studied, whether or not their different conditions that caused their blindness had also some contributing effect to their problems with sleep.
It's a really good question. People always ask me this because they want to know, for example, the difference between people who've been blind from birth or people who have acquired blindness later in life, or between different types of conditions. And we have looked to see whether there are differences in your rhythms between either different types of disorders or how long it was since people lost their light perception or how rapidly they lost their sight. And in the numbers of people we've studied so far, we can't find a relationship. But that may be just a small number of people, even though we've studied more than 80 people now in a very detailed way to look at their circadian rhythms and their disorders. It probably isn't enough people when you start to divide those 80 people up into all the different types of reasons why people are blind, then we only end up with very small numbers to then look at effects of the specific diseases. So we are continuing to do these studies to really try and focus on whether particular disease types do affect your rhythms. One thing in particular which we did look at was people with retinitis pigmentosa. And we found that the majority of people with RP do tend to have normal rhythms. Even though they may have sleep disorders, which has nothing to do with a circadian rhythm disorder. But having RP didn't seem to cause a circadian problem. And we think that may be because the rods which primarily are primarily damaged in RP may not be involved in gathering the light for circadian rhythms. So that's really our only lead on particular disorders, as well as people who are bilaterally nucleated, where we always found that they have this cyclic sleep-wake disorder. I'm sorry I can't answer your question.
I was just wondering, because it's basically the endocrine system is a big, and I was thinking too of also the, is it the hypothalamus, or are they considered the pineal gland, the master gland as far as regulating the body clock?
Yeah, there are two things. The body clock itself is in the hypothalamus. It's in a group of cells, paired group of cells called the suprachiasmatic nuclei. So that's in the hypothalamus, and the light information goes from the eye directly to this area in the hypothalamus to control our rhythms. But then from the hypothalamic area, the signal is sent to the pineal gland, which is where melatonin is produced, your natural melatonin, which is one of the rhythms we can measure when we're looking for disorders.
Right, and that's like Marmalena was saying, that's what some people, I think, call it the third eye.
That's right. It was classified as the third eye, and Descartes many centuries ago sort of classified the pineal gland as the seat of the soul and the place where your soul resided, and was called the third eye then. And as I said earlier on, in birds and reptiles, the pineal gland is the clock and is directly photosensitive, so you can shine light through the skulls. If you just shine a light, it goes through the skull of birds and reptiles and affects the pineal gland directly. And the pineal gland is the clock. However, in higher mammals, in humans, then the pineal gland and the clock become separate things. So the clock is in the hypothalamus, and then it sends a signal to the pineal gland to tell the pineal gland when to produce melatonin and when not.
Right, it's the whole balancing act of the hormones themselves.
That's right, they all interact, yes. And then we think that melatonin feeds back onto the hypothalamus, and other hormones probably do as well, to sort of make sure that the animal or the person interacts properly with the environment, and that's really the whole point of having a biological clock, is to make sure that you do the right things at the right time. You need to be awake when the food source is around, you need to be asleep when it's not. So you need to interact with the environment, and this is why we evolved a body clock in order that we could do this.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
And we have another call. It's just about half past the hour here on Blind Spot, where our telephone number is area code 212-812-2800. And the PIN is 0480-5512. Good evening. You're on Blind Spot with Dr. Lockley.
Hi, Marlene. It's Cindy.
Hi, Cindy.
I just had a question I was wondering about. Have any of the studies done any comparison between employed and unemployed blind people? I wonder if, you know, having a routine going through, you know, during a day, maybe keeping busier than someone who may be unemployed, has anything to do with the sleep patterns?
That's, again, a good question. We did look at that. We have looked at people and compared those who were either working or not working, or people who lived with a family or people who lived alone. And again, with the numbers of people we've studied, we couldn't find a significant relationship. However, there is some good evidence from some case studies done by a colleague of mine, Dr. Elizabeth Clearman, who works at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, showing that if you change your schedule, you can change your body clock. So even though the effects of, they're called non-photic-like time cues, which means time cues other than light, which could affect your body clock, even though they seem not to be as powerful as light at resetting your rhythms, she was able to show that if you change someone's schedule to a 23.8-hour day, if you changed it slightly from 24, that in one individual his rhythm drifted to match this new schedule. So it is possible that these other time cues, other than light, so keeping a schedule, keeping a strict sleep-wake pattern or strict meal times or strict activity through the day, could certainly have an influence on the clock. And that would be something else I would advise people to do if they do have a sleep disorder, is to or a cyclic sleep disorder, is to try and keep a strict schedule as well as they can. I know it can be very frustrating for people who are unable to do that, but at least it should be sort of the first attempt before beginning to take any medication, just to see if you keep a strict schedule, whether it does then affect your rhythms. So you're right, there probably is a difference between people who have to keep a very strict schedule because they have to go to work at a certain time or have to travel at a certain time. But again, it's a very individual thing, so
sure.
It's certainly a possibility, and we want to do more studies. Part of the research we're hoping to start at the Brigham Women's Hospital is to look more at the effects of these other time cues, like activity and like exercise, and like keeping a strict schedule. So it's something we're very interested in pursuing.
Very much. It's very interesting.
Thanks.
All right, Cindy. Take
Bye-bye.
Care. Thanks for the call. And we have another call. Good evening. You are on Blind Spot with Dr. Lockley.
Hi there.
Hi there.
I have, I'm Bobcat.
And oh, hello, Bobcat.
I'm calling from Canada.
It's nice to hear you.
I'm up. Hi, Dr. Lockley. Yes, we can't get melatonin in Canada. I don't know why they've decided that we're not supposed to have it. But I have heard of people getting it from the United States through mail order. And apparently there is no difficulty. It's just as a comment I wanted to make, but I have two questions. The first one is there any relationship between serotonin and sleep disorders? I'm on Prozac, which apparently affects the serotonin level in the brain, and I'm just wondering if there's any connection between those things, antidepressants and things like that. And my other question will be on just what to put in a sleep diary.
Okay. Well, first of all, the melatonin question, I'm not sure how the system works in Canada, but certainly in the UK. It isn't available in health food stores in the UK either, but it can be gained on prescription from a primary care physician or a general practitioner. Mm-hmm. So I would first of all check whether that's the same in Canada.
Okay.
And see whether it can be prescribed. I'm sure that a physician could prescribe melatonin if a pure source could be found. And hopefully at the end of the show we'll have that information to Marlene so physicians could get that source. So I would check whether that's the case, and then if that was, then some sort of study, first of all, to see whether you have a cyclic disorder, which we could then work out the schedule for and the number of weeks it takes to go a full schedule before working out the treatment. The serotonin. Serotonin is very linked to melatonin. Serotonin is one of the precursors of melatonin. So melatonin is produced from serotonin in the pineal gland. So dietary tryptophan, which is an amino acid, is converted to serotonin and then to melatonin in a series of pathways in the brain. So altering serotonin levels may affect sleep, not necessarily through affecting melatonin itself, but serotonin on its own is probably involved in the regulation of sleep and certainly involved in the in different sleep stages. So by altering your serotonin levels, you may alter something about your sleep. But that's probably a separate thing from the effect of changing serotonin on your own melatonin levels. Your own endogenous melatonin probably doesn't affect sleep directly. It doesn't make you go to sleep. It isn't a hormone which makes you sleep. It tends to be a hormone which facilitates sleep, or it's been described as opening of the sleep gate, where melatonin facilitates it and lets other systems allow you to go to sleep. So altering your melatonin levels, your internal melatonin levels, may not necessarily affect your sleep from a body clock perspective, but certainly changing serotonin may affect your sleep. And the final question, the sleep diary question. We can give you the type of sleep diary we use, and I can give you a more specific answer maybe after the show. But the type of things you would want to record are how long it takes you to fall asleep, what time you actually think you fell asleep at night, whether you woke up in the night and how often you woke up, and maybe for how long, what time you woke up in the morning, and then maybe rate your sleep quality using something like a 1 to 9 scale. You could say that 1 was very good and 9 was very bad, and you could rate your own sleep quality. And the other, and probably the most important thing to record if you're going to keep a sleep diary, is when you have any naps in the daytime. Our research using sleep diaries, we've used sleep diaries in all the 80 people we've studied so far, show that if you look at the incidence and the timing of daytime naps, it's a very, very clear indicator of this type of cyclic sleep-wake disorder, because people go through phases where they're really unable to stay awake, and even if they're at work or even if they're traveling on the train or something, then they just can't help themselves from falling asleep even for a minute or two. So I would keep details about your nighttime sleep, when you wake up, when you go back to sleep, and then certainly keep information about when you have daytime naps. And if there are times when you really would like to sleep, but you can't because you're in the middle of a meeting at work or something, then you should maybe record that as well, because we may see a pattern in the times when you feel very, very tired, and then add that to the times when you fall asleep, and we can usually get a very good idea of your sleep pattern.
Excellent. I'm glad you brought that up, because, you know, I was seeing a doctor who said, well, just fight through it. And I found it hard to explain to this doctor that when I'm at the point where I feel I can't stay awake, it's irresistible. You know, if I'm in a situation where I would not be able to lie down and go to sleep right there, well, then I can fight through it, you know. But
it's very difficult. I mean, it's very difficult for people to understand it. And really, I don't understand it because I've not been through it in the same way. But it's like asking people to stay awake in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
It's very similar to the type of pattern that shift workers suffer from, or from people who get very severe jet lag, where your body clock tells you it's one time of day, but you're trying to do something else. So in that situation where your body's telling you to go to sleep in the middle of the day, that is your body's nighttime. So of course it's trying to make you go to sleep, but you've got to stay awake because you have work to do, you have social life to lead. But then when nighttime comes, your body thinks it's the middle of the day. But of course, everyone else is telling you it's night, telling you should try and go to sleep at this time. So it's really like having a permanent jet lag or working permanent shifts, but these shifts are always changing.
Mm-hmm.
And unless people have been through that experience for a long time, then it's very difficult for them to understand it. But part of the work we're doing is hopefully getting the message out to more and more physicians that if they see a patient who has no light perception, who complains of sleep disorders, we would hope one of the things they would think about is them having a circadian rhythm disorder and the cyclic sleep-wake disorder specifically, and do the type of sleep diary study we talked about, or do something a bit more in-depth to try and work out whether it is that. I don't think it's acceptable to try and say to people, you know, you can live through it or it will go eventually, or you can try and try and work your way through it. People should try and identify that it really is a disorder, and that helps to start with even before we do any treatment. So,
this is very encouraging.
If you do the diaries, then you will take them to your physician and talk to them about it.
Yeah, just hearing about these studies has been very encouraging to me because I have been really suffering since January, really suffering severely. And it just happened to come at a time when I quit smoking, which is supposed to be good for me. Here I'm going, where's all the extra energy I'm supposed to have?
Oh, but it is good for you.
Oh, I'm not going to go back to that.
Oh, no, you mustn't.
But just hearing about this is very encouraging to me, and I'm going to go now so that other people can ask their questions. Pardon me?
Okay. Well, thank you so much for calling, and it's nice to hear your voice. I've seen your name on the list many times.
Thank you.
Have a good evening in Canada.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Good night.
And we have another call. Goodness gracious, I've got other questions, but I'm going to let people ask theirs. Good evening. You are on Blind Spot with Dr. Lockley.
Marlena, this is Steve Bauer from Wichita, Kansas.
Oh, I know that voice.
Hey, how's it
going?
Last
week's Megabyte winner on ACB Radio Interactive.
That's correct.
Uh-huh.
Good evening, Doctor. I'm, like Marlena, I'll tend to use RLF because that's what I grew up with all my life.
Yeah, then they changed it on us.
I know. It's just not fair. But generally, I can fall asleep fairly easily, but tend to wake up about 3 or 4 in the morning and rarely can go back to sleep. Is there an approximate time I would want to try taking melatonin X number of hours before I want to wake up?
Okay. It's a difficult question without... I know I keep saying this, it must be frustrating to people, but it's very difficult to give specific advice on specific disorders because until we know whether you have the cyclic sleep problem or the thing I talked about before where you have this advanced sleep phase, then the timing of the melatonin would be different for those different conditions. If someone had a condition where they felt very tired in the early evening and fell to sleep very quickly at night but then woke up every night at 3 o'clock forever and never changed, then that would suggest to us that they have this advanced sleep phase syndrome. And what we would try and do then is maybe give you a melatonin treatment where we would gradually step it back to a later time. So it would hopefully pull your clock to a more normal time, so you were sleeping maybe through the night and waking up a bit later. But if you had a cyclic problem, and remember some of these cyclic disorders can last for hundreds of days, so you may have a very, very long time where it doesn't appear that the sleep is changing, but then all of a sudden it may change, or it may change very gradually. And then we would use a completely different type of treatment, and we would try and time it specifically to your clock and fix it at the time and hope that the clock latches onto that. So although I'm sorry I'm not able to give specific advice, those would be the two types of approaches we would take. But before starting the treatment, we would want to do one of these assessments, and we would sort of recommend keeping the sleep diaries for at least a month, for at least 4 weeks, to really see whether there's a change in the sleep or whether it's staying exactly the same. And the other thing we have done before in the studies is to take some urine samples, which people can collect usually quite easily, and we can measure the hormone melatonin in urine samples. We can measure its metabolite, and we can look at the timing of the melatonin rhythm and compare that to the timing of the sleep. And with those two bits of information, we can say for sure whether you have a permanently early rhythm or whether you have this cyclic disorder. So sort of keeping the diary and maybe arranging to have some urine samples collected and analyzed could help us determine that, and then we would work out the treatment based on that information. So I'm sorry that's not too helpful, but if you want to give us a call and maybe join one of our research studies, we may be able to work that out for you.
Well, that was actually going to be one of my questions, so while Steve's on the phone, let me throw that in. Are you still looking for more people to
Absolutely.
Help you? Okay, why don't we talk about that for a second. Steve, stay on if you want, or or okay. whatever works for you. I don't want to cut you off. I want to make sure you get your full time here. But how can people contact you, Steve Lockley? I got two Steves here. how can people contact you if they're interested in the study, and what does it involve?
Well, there are several different studies which we're hoping to run. The main one would involve some work at home, where people would keep sleep diaries at home and collect urine samples at home, and we have all the equipment set up so people can do that individually without any help at home. And then we would ask them to come in the laboratory, we would ask them to visit Boston and spend some time in the laboratory, where we would measure things in maybe a more controlled manner. But we would be measuring sleep in people, we'd be measuring their hormones, we may be measuring their temperature rhythms. But then we hope in the future to also extend some of our studies to continue looking at the effects of melatonin and those types of studies, which would probably be done in their homes. And we may bring people into the laboratory for a few days rather than the study we're in at the moment, where people come into the lab for a longer time. So there are a whole variety of different studies we're hoping to run. So what we would like people to do is, if they're interested in taking part in any type of study, to maybe give us a call at Brigham Women's Hospital, and I've got a number I could give you, and then we'll put them onto our database. We'll ask our recruiting staff to ask you some questions and to discuss the type of problems you have, and then we will discuss whether you want to take part in some of the research projects going on.
Why don't we run the number?
Okay. Well, the number to call will be, it's Boston, so it's 617, and it's 278-0698.
That's 617-278-0698.
That's right.
Okay. All right. And Steve Bauer, did you have any other questions?
Well, actually, I have one other one. I know that you can't speak specifically to the local sleep clinic that we do have here in Wichita, but smaller sleep clinics that are around the country, such as the one that we have here, would that be of any benefit to us to consider going to for just one of their overnight evaluations?
If you're having other types of symptoms other than just this inability to sleep on a particular schedule, then it would be, because the type of sleep clinics that you're talking about would be able to recognize whether you have another type of sleep disorder, for example, sleep apnea, which I mentioned earlier on. They would do an overnight screen to test whether you were having problems with your upper airway, which is affecting your sleep. And other types of sleep disorders would be identified by a sleep clinic. They also would be able to identify a circadian sleep disorder, which is the type that we're talking about in blind people. But that probably wouldn't be done over an overnight screening. That would probably have to be done over several weeks with the type of studies I was talking about, with the sleep diaries or with some of the urine samples or laboratory measurements we could make. So they would, of course it would be useful to try and make sure you're not suffering from any other type of sleep disorder, but they would set up a longer term measurement to look at any circadian disorders. And we could advise individuals or people who are looking to try and assess themselves or want to discuss with the clinics how they might assess themselves, how they might go about that, and we'd be happy to do that.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Okay, Steve, have a good night. And we are coming up to the end of the program. My goodness, this hour is flying by.
Yeah.
Our telephone number is 212-812-2800, and the PIN is 0480-5512. You know, one thing I'm curious about, and I meant to try to sort of do a straw poll of everyone who called tonight, and I neglected to do it, but it's my belief, certainly among the people whom I know well enough to know that they do this, but it's my belief that many of us who are blind fall asleep with something going on. In my case, for example, I've got to have a book or talk radio. I've got to have a talking book or talk. It can't be music. It's got to be talking. And I think the second company we keep in business is a pillow speaker manufacturer. And I'm just wondering whether or not, despite the fact that I certainly find, and I know others whom I've talked with about this, find that it's relaxing, is it really relaxing us, or is it adding to our sleep problem?
It's a good question, and we haven't specifically studied that in our studies, but often people will advise some of the behavioral therapies to help you sleep are to use relaxation tapes, or to use some sort of soothing sounds or some sort of quiet music or something that is soothing. So that would be one of the behavioral therapies which people would try and use if you're having some sleep disorders which are not related to circadian rhythms. So it may be that that sort of soothing voice may help individuals to sleep. But whether, you know, that sort of thing would work for everybody, and it would really depend on the individuals and what they find to be soothing and relaxing themselves. But of course, you know, if you're listening to something which is highly controversial and you, you know, suddenly get angry about something or excited about something, then you know it's very difficult to get back to sleep if you hear that. So anything that can help you relax, to help you sort of become more relaxed before you sleep, will probably help you go to sleep. But then listening to talk shows might in fact have the opposite effect, and get your blood boiling or get you excited about something, and then you'll be awake all night.
So the key is to pick a boring talk show.
Maybe, hopefully not this one.
No, definitely not this one. I know for me, I cannot fall asleep no matter how tired I am. I've got to have something talk to me. And we have a call. Who's going to talk to us now? Good evening. You're on Blind Spot with Dr. Lockley.
Hi, Marlena.
Hey, Sue.
Hi, Doctor. This is a very interesting show. I'm just curious, are more of the people that you find with sleep disorders who are blind men than women?
We studied more men than women only because that's how the people came to us when we advertised for people to take part in the study. When we split them up into men and women and looked at the disorders, then we didn't see a difference between men and women who have visual impairment. There are some preliminary reports that women and men do report sleep disorders differently.
Mm-hmm.
So in sighted individuals, if you ask them to say whether they have a sleep disorder, there are men and women reported in different ways. And there has been some studies that show women tend to report more sleep disorders or report more tiredness than men. But whether those studies have been well controlled for social factors, for example, like running families or trying to work and keep a family as well, I'm not sure if that's been properly controlled for. But people are looking to see if there are differences between the genders.
And do you see that maybe there's a change in people's disorder as their age changes, like they might find as a kid and then as an adult it's different?
Not in the people we've studied so far, but again, we haven't really studied someone for long enough to see if that makes a change. What you would really need to do is study somebody all through their life and see how their sleep changes to really know whether age is itself affected sleep. Your sleep does change with age. We know that children sleep in a very particular way that adults don't. Adolescents tend to sleep at a later time, and that isn't just adolescent laziness, by the way. It's a real problem where adolescents' circadian rhythms are set at a slightly later time, so they do want to stay up late and wake up late, and it isn't just them wanting to stay out all night. But then our sleep changes from our adolescent years all the way through our lives, but it tends not to be a change in their circadian rhythm disorder. It's probably a change in the sleep centers in the brain.
I mean, because you do hear a lot of older people complain that they can't sleep well, and et cetera.
That's right, and there are more sleep disorders in older people, and that maybe for several reasons. It may be a change in their, like I said, the part of the brain that controls sleep may change how it organizes sleep. It may also be an effect of the light that that older people receive, because as you age, your lens changes in sighted people. So the quality of the light and the intensity of the light that might reach the body clock in these older people may change as well as you get older. So there are many different factors which may change with age, and work going on at the Brigham Women's Hospital with particularly Dr. Jean Duffy and Dr. Charles Seisler, looking at aging effects on sleep, are trying to investigate whether it's a problem with age itself or whether it's just people changing and not really to do with the aging process.
Well, if you have one to post this to, I'll get off here quick. It'd be really interesting to know if there's a website we could go to read more, because obviously it's a big topic. And
well, unfortunately, I don't have a website. What I'm going to do as a result of this is maybe set one up quite quickly and see if we can get one going where people can access this. But if you call the number I gave before, then we'll be able to send you some either some hard copies of some of the papers we've published, or we can send text documents.
Do you want to give the number again?
Yeah, I can do it. It's 617-278-0698.
And for anyone who didn't get that, if you just email me at marlena@acbradio.org, I will send it to you.
Great show.
Before you go, I want to ask you a question.
Okay.
Do you fall asleep with sound?
I used to, but I don't need to do that anymore, it seems. But if my husband isn't here, then I have to have sound. So maybe I fall asleep to his snoring, but don't tell him I said that. but as a kid, finally my mom gave up, and she let me have my transistor radio, and you know, she used to get mad because I had this big shortwave radio with these headphones, and she'd think I was going to strangle myself with the cord, but I never did. But I always listened to the radio, and I'd fall asleep, and then I'd wake up in a little while and turn it off. But I never slept very much, even as a kid. Never more than about 6 or 7 hours. It used to drive my parents crazy.
Well,
so they finally just gave in and let me have the radio.
Well, everyone's different. I mean, the old wives' tale that we should have 8 hours sleep a night, you know, it does depend on individuals. People on average sleep between probably 6 and 9 hours. Some people need 6 hours and some people need 9 hours.
And actually, so, on the weekend when I sleep 9 hours, I feel horrible the whole day.
Okay, so... you know, you can see where some people would sleep 9 hours and get up feeling very, very refreshed.
Yeah, like my husband. So,
okay.
Anyway.
So that sort of sleep duration is very individual, and we should get away from the idea that you have to have X number of hours of sleep per night. You should get sleep per night, but you should get at least 6 hours, but some people may need not much more than 6 hours. Other people may need a bit longer.
Well, great show. I'll run, and I'm glad I came on tonight. So thanks, Marlena. Good
okay.
job as always.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Okay. We are just about out of time here. Do you have an email address that people could contact you at? Is that possible?
Yes, I do, yep. If they can't call the number, then they could call me at my email, which is slockley, which is slockley, and that's at hms.harvard.edu.
Okay, and again, if people didn't get that or didn't get the phone number, feel free to drop me a note to Marlena, M-A-R-L-A-I-N-A, at acbradio.org. And I've been taking some notes here during the show, and I will give you that information. One last really quick question. Do things like hot baths, hot tea, and warm milk really help?
Again, it's really individual. They probably don't have a great deal to do with making you fall asleep by acting on the sleep centers in the brain itself, but they probably do help with relaxation. So that idea I talked about before with the music or with the radio, anything that you can do to help you relax, to help your body sort of slow down, to sort of wind down a bit, all of these things are going to help you relax. And if some people like to relax with a hot bath, it may help them. If others like to relax with hot milk, it may help them. But again, it's very individual. So really anything that helps you relax and wind down would probably be a good thing to do before you go to sleep. You don't want to be rushing around, paying bills, you know, racing around the minute before you go to sleep. You really want to be winding down and trying to relax after the day.
So it's kind of getting yourself into the mindset that I'm going to have a successful night's sleep tonight.
That's very important. That whole behavior, keeping yourself relaxed when you go to sleep, making sure you're warm, making sure you're in a comfortable place and relaxed, all of those things will help you fall asleep.
Well, I appreciate your time so much, Steve. I know that this has been very interesting to many folks, and it really is quite a hot topic on the list, and I will be more than happy to funnel people through to you, and we'll keep in touch by email, and maybe you'll come on and join us again when the study progresses even further.
No, I would love to. It's been wonderful. It's been really interesting to hear people talking about the sleep disorders, and I'm hoping just the show and giving them the information that it really is a body clock disorder. It's not just that they have a problem which nobody understands, that there really are real reasons why people have sleep disorders who have lost their light perception. Hopefully that will be a help in itself, but I would love to come back.
And again, if people want to find out more information about the studies, that Steve has talked about, please call area code 617-278-0698. I'm Marlena Lieberg, and this has been Blind Spot, and next week I think we'll go to the kitchen. We'll make food that'll make us sleepy. Thanks for joining us tonight on Blind Spot. Everyone have a wonderful week. Be safe and be smart. See you next week. You've been listening to Blind Spot on ACB Radio. Thanks to our technical people, Chris Bell, for making the music happen, and Jonathan Mosen for making the program possible. If you have any ideas for something you might like to hear on Blind Spot, drop me an email. It's Marlena, M-A-R-L-A-I-N-A, at acbradio.org.